The following is a CNA podcast.
I'm Jamie Ho, and on the Climate Conversations today, I'm talking to the International Energy Agency, or the IEA. Now, the IEA was formed in 1974, deep in the context of the oil crisis, and foremost in the minds of its founding members was the issue of energy security and cooperation between countries on energy policy. But with time has come a necessary evolution in its focus. From energy security, it's now also about the energy transition and sustainable and alternative energies, all in the name of addressing climate change. I'm talking to Dr. Timo Gul, who is the head of energy technology policy, and he speaks to me from Paris. Timo, welcome.
Hi, Jamie. Good to meet you. Thanks for having me.
No problems. Now, we're going to talk about this new IEA report titled Net Zero by 2050. You're a co-author. It says a roadmap for the global energy sector. Well, firstly, congratulations. It's fresh off the oven. It was released in May, right?
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, it was launched on the 18th of May, indeed. Yes. It's 1 month ago almost.
We've spoken about net zero emissions on many occasions during past podcasts, but you've set yourselves quite a significant task in situating net zero emissions within, I'd say, the constraints and potential of global energy systems. And you address sort of issues like energy access, economic growth. It's really heavy stuff. And I'd like you to summarize for us the roadmap as you've outlined. But before you start, I found this line and I love it from your report, that in setting the pathway for the world's governments, the world economy in 2030 is some 40% larger than today, but uses 7% less energy. Now, how on earth are we going to get there? And maybe you can tell me by summarizing the report.
Let me just start off saying that obviously the global climate problem is an energy issue. The energy sector is responsible for the vast majority of global greenhouse gas and particular CO2 emissions. So with many, many more governments increasingly making pledges to reach net zero emissions, increasingly by the year 2050, we felt it's time to come out with a detailed roadmap so as to see what would this actually mean in practice for the energy sector as a whole and for the world as a whole to reach net zero emissions, CO2 emissions from the energy sector by 2050. And we found basically three main things. We wanted this roadmap to be as concrete as possible in order for people to understand the needs that come with such a transitions as well as the opportunity. And three things really stood out here. First, we need to accelerate deployment of all the technologies that we have. And that goes a bit to your point, what we can achieve by 2030 and how. There are three key elements that we generally highlight. Renewables are cost-effective. They're to be scaled and to be deployed. We believe that aggressively scaling up renewables deployment over the next decade is one key pillar for putting ourselves on track to reach net zero emissions by the year 2050. Second, electric vehicles. Key technology, which is currently rising strongly in global car markets, has reached 6% of global car sales over the first quarter of this year. We need to bring this share up to 60% within the next 10 years. And the third element is energy efficiency. We know the policies that can be effective. So we believe that the 4% year-on-year decrease of global energy intensity is a way to put us on track to net zero emissions by the year 2050. The second key element of a transition to net zero is we really need to innovate. It is important to recognize that deployment of the technologies that we have and innovating on the technologies that we don't yet have fully commercially in the market are no antagonists in the fight against climate change. There are, in fact, two sides of the same coin. We need to, in this decade, accelerate the deployment of all the technologies that we have ready in the market and make sure that the next generation of clean energy technologies that we will need, that they are ready at scale towards the end of this decade in order to bring us to net zero emissions by the year 2050. And finally, of course, CO2 and greenhouse gas emissions are intrinsically linked to the use of fossil fuels. So governments will need to accelerate policies that can help reduce the demand for fossil fuels, for coal, for oil, and for natural gas.
That's a great summary. And I wanted to jump in on the point that you made about, therefore, clean energy. And the report talks about the global investments that are needed in clean energy. And it said that worldwide, this needs to be tripled by 2030 to around $4 trillion if we are to meet the 2050 net zero targets. Now, this is obviously massive. you've painted some of the examples of where this can be done, but I would imagine that therefore progress is going to be mixed somehow with governments and various jurisdictions moving at different speeds. So paint a picture where you think the greatest potentials are going to be.
Yeah, good point, Jamie. Obviously, a transition doesn't happen without investments. We are only going to get to that point if we manage to get the capital that exists at a global level into the right channels in order to accelerate the transition to a more cleaner energy sector in the longer term. As you rightly said, we in this net zero pathway, we are seeing a surge in investment in clean energy technologies that rises from just above $1 trillion to more than $4 trillion by the year 2030, so more than three times the current level of investment. There are three key elements here that are important in terms of the investment needs. Number one is electricity, of course. Towards 2030, the annual investment in renewables in the electricity sector in particular is around $1.3 trillion in our pathway to net zero emissions, which is in fact higher than the highest level we ever spent on fossil fuel supply, which was $1.2 trillion back in 2014. The second element is investment in clean energy infrastructure. We always focus on investment into renewables and various other different technologies, but it's very important that we invest in enabling infrastructure as well over the next decade. This as well in our pathway triples from around $300 billion today to $900 billion by the year 2030. What is it that I mean by enabling infrastructure? I mean electricity networks. I mean charging stations for electric vehicles. I mean hydrogen refueling stations, import-export terminals for low-carbon fuels at ports, infrastructure to enable carbon capture utilization and storage, such as CO2 pipelines, storage facilities, etc. All this will require large-scale investments over the next decade. And the third element is really about end-use sectors. Consumers, businesses, they will be the ones who will need to invest in transforming the way they use energy, deep retrofits in buildings, transforming industrial processes, purchasing new low-emission vehicles, more efficient appliances, etc. Here, we are seeing a jump in investment from around $500 billion in recent years to roughly $1,700 billion by the year 2030. So a huge need to accelerate clean energy investment in order to get us on a path to net zero by 2050.
I want to also then talk about something that you raise about the innovations that are needed in clean energy. And I don't know whether this simplifies things, because I'm going to look at it from the perspective of a developing country. And we're looking at these huge price tags in terms of investments that are needed. Now, for a developing country government, they look at such price tags. What's the balance in terms of the need to develop new innovations at scale? Or is it a matter of, for lack of a better word, technology transfer and adapting existing innovations to their circumstances and needs? Are innovations already out there that are ready to be utilized by many developing countries which have very specific constraints?
Yeah, totally. I mean, these technologies that I've been talking about, renewable energies, energy efficiency, electric cars, here we have seen those cost reductions over the last couple of years that basically make them a more relevant technology also for emerging economies. But the point here is, again, coming back to investments. If you look at, we just released a report on financing the clean energy transition in emerging and developing economies. What you basically see is that roughly two-thirds of the global population are in such economies. Much of the demand growth is set to come from these countries, arguably rightly so, because they have a much lower per capita energy use and per capita CO2 emissions today. So this is a very normal development. But only one-fifth of global clean energy investment is going into these countries. As I said earlier, global capital availability is not really the issue here. It's more the cost of capital in these countries that is higher than in advanced economies for a variety of reasons, of course. What we are basically saying is concerted action will be needed from international financial institutions, from governments, etc., towards COP so as to ensure that we are not developing a new fault line in our joint quest to reach net zero emissions by the year 2050 or 1.5 degrees more broadly.
Just one more quick question on this sort of rough topic of investments before I head on. We are sort of 1.5 years into this pandemic. It's still not done. And you've heard people talk about green recoveries, new investments in green growth. Looking at it into 2030, we're already sort of 1.5 years towards 2030. How optimistic are you seeing how governments have so far tried to recover, that we're sort of on the right track in terms of longer term green growth?
I'm seeing a lot of positive developments around the world. Obviously, there are many things that we hope can be accelerated in terms of the priorities that are being set by governments, also by industries. But we are seeing a lot of positive developments in terms of the ambitions that countries are setting themselves. Think about the G7 leaders document last weekend, where the country is firmly committed to working towards the 1.5 degrees goal, 2050 decarbonization challenge. There is a lot of such positive development that is currently underway. But I think what is currently very important is that governments set long-term targets, but then also establish the concrete policies and the intermediate milestones that will be needed to get to net zero by the year 2050. So industry, investors, they're all asking themselves, what is the direction of travel? And this is an obviously important question for them to make investment decisions. What are the priorities that governments are setting? What are the instruments governments will be choosing? So for a long-term transition of the energy sector of such speed and scale as it is required to reach net zero by 2050, it will just be important that governments bring forward not only a target for 2050, but also detailed plans that work backwards from that 2050 endpoint and lay out how the country intends to be getting there.
One of the things that you raised at the beginning was the role that the fossil fuel sector is going to play in this overall transition 2030 as well as 2050. Now, if you look at it sort of big picture, the oil majors all claim to be moving in the right direction. Governments too are pushing them in that direction as they are themselves. As you look to such ambitious goals, how do you think more ambition is going to be deliverable? Does it entail a change in the relationship between oil and gas sectors? The fact that governments and countries and economies still depend on them significantly, how would they take guidance, say, from your roadmap? If I were an oil major, if I were a government and I see that a new relationship needs to be found in terms of oil and gas and its relationship with the economy, what is the guidance that they can take from your report, say?
I think our report lays out both the opportunities and the challenges that come with the transition to net zero emissions. And I think the way to read it is, what is required from the global energy sector to reach net zero emissions, and where are the technology and other opportunities for us to get there? If you think about the role of the oil and gas industry, for example, the oil and gas industry has a significant skill set that is very conducive towards some of the future technologies that we're talking about here, those for which we need to innovate and that we need to be starting to be deploying. It's about low carbon gases, for example. The industry knows how to deal with gases, of course, when it comes to hydrogen, biomethane gases. There is a lot of skills that the industry has and that can be deployed usefully. Think about mining, for example. The demand for coal falters in our scenario, net zero emissions by the year 2050. But at the same time, the need for critical minerals rises significantly. Think about all the technologies that we'll need, like solar PV, batteries for electric cars, and many, many more. They will bring up the demand for copper, lithium, various rare earth metals, manganese, all these kind of minerals that we are already using to some extent in the energy sector, but for which the demand increase in our net zero pathway is actually as high as a factor of 7 over the next 10 years alone. And obviously, the mining industry is well placed here with its skills, with its workers to tap into such new opportunities. So it will be a question of governments setting the right frameworks, making sure that the direction of travel is clear, that policies are put in place to bring down fossil fuel demand on the one hand. And it's about the industry reading the signs and grasping some of these new opportunities that are coming forward by governments all around the world.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit too about coal and your report, and you've also mentioned a little bit about that. Talk about how coal and the transition away from coal is going to be, I would imagine, crucial factor in the path to 2030 even. And especially, you know, coming from Asia, where energy needs are still growing and countries still needing access to that. What's the pathway for governments and industries in that sector?
It is a challenging pathway for coal moving forward, of course. When you think about uses of coal today, we are thinking about the power sector first and foremost, but we're also using coal, of course, in different heavy industry applications. And there are solutions that you can easily apply for every single country. Every single country has a very different energy sector and a very different starting point. You mentioned the question of energy access, of course, which we are achieving full universal access to energy by the year 2030 in our pathway, on the back, by and large, of renewables, of course, as a key pillar of getting electricity access in developing countries. But the existing fleet of coal-fired power plants, of heavy industrial facilities, they have very different age profiles all around the world. When you look at North America or Europe, coal-fired power plants are 40 years old and older. Whereas if you look into many of the developing and emerging economies, many of these plants have been built only over the last 10 to 15 years. So exactly, the technology solution to deal with that, or the policy solution to deal with that, will differ. CCUS is an important part of the solution. The use of ammonia in coal-fired power plants is increasingly being looked at, in particular in Southeast Asia. So the choices that a country in Europe may be different than the choices that a country in Southeast Asia might want to take.
I'm glad you raised energy access, that term, and you did come out quite clearly in the report as well. I suppose it recognizes that even as we talk about technology and renewables, there are hundreds of millions of people around the world who have no access to electricity still, and clean, for example, clean cooking solutions. Explain why this is a big part of your report.
I think it is important to recognize that clean energy transition is both for and it's about people. It is making sure that the needs of the people who actually use energy on a day-to-day basis or want to use energy in a cleaner and more efficient way or use it at all because they currently don't have access to it. It is important that they are on board for this type of transition to net zero emissions. Reaching universal access by the year 2030 is a key sustainable development goal of the United Nations, and rightly so. Energy per se is not a bad thing. Energy is the lifeblood of the global economy, and it helps us to execute our daily needs. It helps us to grow economically. It is not energy that is the problem. It's the emissions that come with the use of energy. And we believe that there is a viable pathway to provide people that are currently deprived of access to energy and otherwise rely on the use of inefficient cook stoves, traditional biomass for cooking. And there's a viable pathway for them to have universal access by the year 2030.
You know, I also want to talk about energy efficiency. And you mentioned that this was one of the pillars of the pathway to 2050. Now, you are the head of technology, Timur, and I'll tap your brains on this. Obviously, technology and energy efficiency is going to be one of the most important levers in the overall transformation. So in terms of that, how far more do you think buildings, industries, national systems can go in terms of energy efficiency? Because I would imagine that, again, capabilities and maturities will differ. So you have Singapore, which claims to be at the forefront of energy efficiency. You have other jurisdictions and cities which may not. But overall, how much more can technology in that sector deliver in terms of deliverables for lowering energy use significantly?
Yeah, good question, Jamie. And we always try to highlight that energy efficiency is really the first fuel. There is still a lot of untapped potential globally to improve energy efficiency. Singapore is obviously a country that has made huge strides on energy efficiency. There are many other countries in Asia, like Japan, for example, that has also always been at the forefront of accelerating the efficient use of energy. But at a global scale, there is still a lot that can be done. As I said earlier, we believe that the energy intensity of the global economy must fall by 4% year on year to 2030 if we want to be on a pathway towards net zero emissions by 2050. In recent years, however, this energy intensity has only fallen by around 2%. So it's roughly a doubling of the energy intensity effort. And to make this a bit more concrete, today, 1 in 20 of the buildings globally are being retrofitted to be zero carbon ready for a net zero pathway. This is a factor of four quicker. 1 in 5 of the buildings need to be, of the existing buildings, need to be retrofitted to be zero carbon ready by the year 2030. So there is a lot that has to be done. on the efficiency of the way we use energy currently, and of course, through electrifying end use, using electric cars more, etc., there will be additional efficiency gains that can be reaped, and that can actually be reaped in all the countries around the world.
Before I get to the last questions, I'm going to talk a little bit about electrification as well, since we were on that earlier on, and the need to electrify all the economic sectors. And the report also mentions the need for our, quote, electricity system flexibility. Explain what that means and what governments need to start thinking about now in parallel with expanding the use of renewables. What does this flexibility mean?
Electrification is a key pillar of any transition to net zero emissions, of course. What we are seeing in our scenario is three things that are happening in parallel. Number one, electricity becomes the largest source of energy demand by the year 2050. Roughly half of global final energy demand in our scenario comes from electricity through the use in transport, in some of the industrial applications, through the use in buildings. Today, just to put things into perspective, today, roughly 20% of global final energy consumption are electricity. In our scenario, it's about 50% by the year 2050. This is one thing that is happening. The other thing in terms of electricity is that additional electricity needs come from the need to produce hydrogen, hydrogen-derived fuels, through a process called electrolysis, where you split water into oxygen and hydrogen. So substantial electricity needs coming from there. And finally, the third point is that the share of solar PV and wind in our pathway in global electricity generation rises from roughly 9% today to almost 70% at a global level by the year 2050. The result here is the flexibility needs. The result is that electricity system flexibility needs quadruple by the year 2050. The sources here of flexibility shift away from the use of unabated fossil fuels towards demand-side responses, battery storage systems, reinforced intelligent electricity grids, dispatchable low-emission sources, so hydro, bioenergy, hydrogen-based fuels, or fossil plants equipped with CCUS. So all these kind of new sources of flexibility will be needed at much greater scale than this is the case today.
Now, final question then. And, you know, I like to always throw in a question about jobs and what a green, clean economy is going to look like. And your roadmap sees that, you know, energy transitions does have potential in terms of job creation, but it's interesting that you have recommended that these be spread widely, because the report also does recognize job losses and hardships associated with disruptions. Explain to me why the IEA decided to include this sort of recognition in its report.
It is coming back to a point that I was trying to make earlier. A transition to net zero emission, a clean energy transition, is both for and it's about people. We are employing today in global energy supply around 40 million people in fossil production, in the electricity sector, etc. And what we're seeing in such a pathway is that the transition to clean energy creates around 14 million new jobs, in particular in electricity and in low carbon fuel sectors. But at the same time, around 5 million jobs are lost, in particular in fossil fuels, over half of them in coal mining, followed by oil and gas, and particularly in upstream explorations. Now, it's not as easy as to say we have 14 million new jobs and we are losing 5 million, so the net gain is 9. Well, it's not a simple question of mathematics here.
Yeah.
Most of these jobs that are being lost are actually located close to fossil fuel resources. The structural changes that come with it can cause shocks for the communities, with impacts that may persist over time. So it will be very important to minimize the hardships associated with such disruptions. We have a very important role here for governments that can help with retraining workers, strategically locating new clean energy facilities in those areas that are heavily affected wherever this is possible. Generally speaking, I think it's important to recognize that governments have a central role here. They are the link between the industry, the people, the investors, et cetera. I understand you're calling in from Singapore, is a much appreciated association country of IEA, and the governments are the important part who set the regulations, set the boundary conditions, and they also establish the platforms for exchange, thinking here of the Singapore International Energy Week, for example, which is such a platform where IEA is contributing to share best practices, effect changes across the global energy industry, but also think through the various different implications that the transition to net zero might be having. So putting people at the heart of the clean energy transition is a very, very vital part of any effort that governments may need to take in the next couple of years.
Well, Timo Gul, thank you so much. And speaking about Singapore International Energy Week, I certainly hope to see you either virtually or in person when it comes here in October this year.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Great pleasure being with you today.
And thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on cna.asia. It's all on the orange tab. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. Team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Aaron Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.